Kia and welcome to Primary Thinking, a podcast about primary care and beyond, brought to you by the Health Media. My name is Barbara Fountain and I am editor of New Zealand Doctor Rata Aotearoa. I'm hoping this series of podcasts will be as lively as our theme music, because frankly, primary care rocks. With the arrival of COVID-19 and our newfound enthusiasm for Zoom, I'm taking the opportunity to track down some key people in the sector and learn more about what they've been thinking. In this first episode, I talk to Vanessa Wenick, Christchurch GP and Chair of the New Zealand Medical Association's GP Council. They say good things come to those who wait. Well, due to a few technical glitches in our recording, this podcast is a little delayed and was recorded a couple of weeks back. I hope you enjoy it. And before we get started, here's a little more of that music. Thanks for tuning in to Primary Thinking. With me today to chat about everything and anything is Vanessa Wenick, GP from Christchurch. Welcome, Vanessa.
Thanks, Barbara. It's a pleasure.
You came to my notice, actually, I think it was about 2 or 3 years ago at a GPCME meeting in Rotorua. I seem to recall it was a rather tragic moment when we had the then Health Minister David Clark and Director General of Health Ashley Bloomfield in a session with only about 20 GPs present. Can you remember what you asked Dr. Clark on the day?
Yes, I asked him if there was any government agenda, either right or hidden, to basically to make the GPs public servants, to nationalise GPs, was my question. And he said no, he didn't have that agenda, but it'd be interesting to see what the Simpson report said.
Was that an early political moment for you, or had you been political up to that point?
I guess I've been political my whole life in some ways, but not really outwardly so. All of my friends have been bored by me for years with political discussions. I guess my first real political engagement was actually, 2017 was the last election, but prior to that election, the day after National got re-elected, I went online and signed up to the Labor Party and became a member because I was so determined that next time National was not going to be re-elected. And so I actually made friends with the local nominee for Christchurch Central, Dr. Duncan Webb, and helped him on his next campaign and became quite involved in that. And so that was probably the most political I've ever been, was actually even door knocking on people's doors and saying, this is why you should vote for Labour, and felt quite passionate about that. So yeah, I started with the NZMA. The reason I did that was because I really wanted to see some changes in general practice, and I felt frustrated that there was nowhere to go. And a few of us have been talking about starting a union or something like that. There's a real feeling that GPs are underrepresented and we need somebody that's really got a good, strong voice. And so actually it was Marcia Walker who said to me, should we do it? Should we sign up? Should we actually join the NZMA and become part of this? And I thought, yes, actually, why form something ourselves when there's already such a great established organisation with all of the stuff behind you? Why would you start something new when it would be better to put our efforts and energy behind an organisation that I respected? And I'd read stuff that Kate Baddick had written and was just really impressed with her intellect and her communication skills. And so, yeah, I decided to join the NZMA, and next minute, like pretty much the next week, I was nominated myself for the NZMA GP Council and got elected. But I guess I'd been in Canterbury doing health leadership roles of various kinds for a while. So there's a Pegasus small group leaders group who do education and stuff like that. I've been doing that for 4 or 5 years now. And I'd been part of governance things before that I really enjoyed. So part of home care medical clinical governance group.
You graduated from university in 2002. Can you tell us what happened next?
Right, yeah. Well, after graduation, I worked for a couple of years as a house officer, as we all do, at Timaru Hospital for my first year. And then after that, I actually did 3 months in Ashburton. Then I actually went to the UK and locumed for about 6 months, and then came back to New Zealand and did a 3-month attachment in Queenstown in rural general practice. And then I went into the army. So I actually had a cadetship through the New Zealand Army. They paid for, fourth year on, paid for my medical fees and also gave me a salary. So it was small, but and it's less than the TIs get now, I noticed. But in those days, it was amazing. You know, for me, I'd been living on a student allowance prior to that. And yeah, so it was an absolute lifesaver. So then I had a return of service for them, sort of like a bonding scheme, so that I did 4 years and did 5 years service. So in that time, had a couple of operational deployments, Afghanistan and then East Timor and then Afghanistan again. And kind of the thing about all of that was my first deployment was when my son was 6 months old. The second deployment to East Timor was notable because I deployed after my wedding. And the last deployment to Afghanistan was exactly 2 years after my first deployment. And I had to slightly delay that so that I could sit my GP exams, which I'd had to defer by a year because of my second deployment to East Timor. It was a very busy time. And just before my last deployment, we'd had to move back from Waiuru. So we also moved to Waiuru in the middle of all of that, spent a year there. That was when I was doing the GP training year. And so every Wednesday, I had to travel down to Palmerston North from Waiuru to do the seminar training scheme. So it was a big year. It was a difficult time, actually. And then so once I realised that it wasn't actually fair on my family to continue to make myself available like that, I kind of have a strange view of life, and that if you promise yourself to people that you'll do something and you've said you're there to serve, then you serve at the Queen's convenience, not at my own. So I didn't ever feel like I could say, no, I won't do this. It's not convenient for me right now. There should be lots of reasons why I can't go. To me, it was actually about the fact that this is what I've been asked to do. The other people that I serve with deserve to have somebody there to take care of them. And this has been something that my country is asking of me. I have a strange view of these things. So I did it anyway. And that kind of level of movement even, and being away from your family, takes a toll of its own. Yeah. So I left the Defence Force in about May 2010 and first went and worked in Kaiapoi for a while, which was great. They were a really good team and very generous with me because I was adjusting to being in a total institution and working with normal people. And that, I'll admit, that actually took a bit of adjustment. And then the earthquakes happened in Christchurch. I was still in the territorial, so I was sort of felt that I could go and help out when the earthquakes happened. So I did. And yeah, that was quite a difficult time. You can imagine being in your own city with it all falling apart around you. No matter what kind of experience you've had with disasters or training for these kind of things, training for war, doesn't actually prepare you for driving down your own, you know, city and having the streets be buckled and flooded with liquefaction and cars all over the place and buildings crumpling. So I went and helped out at the Pine Gould building. And so I had my military medics with me, but also a motley crew of doctors from all over the place. And so we stayed, and everybody that we pulled through that tent survived. I mean, there were still people that didn't unfortunately make it. But yeah, it was a very tough time. And so I told the army that Kaiapoi needed me the next day once we'd finished. And I told Kaiapoi that the army needed me. And then I went and went away for a few days and just had some quiet time to myself. But I sort of realized at that time that I couldn't be physically separated from my son by a big river. And so I started looking for a place that was in the center of Christchurch. And I'd been thinking for a while that I wanted to really commit to general practice and find a place to become a partner as a GP. And so fortunately, partner at Papa Nui was deciding to move on. And I got in contact with him and talked about what Papa Nui was like, whether or not I would sort of fit in, and then met the partners and they all agreed. And that was 9 years ago in October. So it's almost like I packed in a lot of activity in my life before I turned 30. And then ever since then, it's been a lot slower and more reasonable. And so I've just finished, like in the last week, a postgrad diploma in public health. And to be able to do that, I had to cut down my hours at Papanui from 8:10 down to 4:10 for a while and back up to 6:10 now. But in that time, it actually just gave me space to think about what I want to do with my life and what I actually care about. And that's when I started to become involved more in, you know, outside of my own little world and looking more at the bigger picture of general practice. So, yeah, bit of a roundabout way of telling you that story.
So doing the Diploma of Public Health, has that had an impact on how you work in general practice?
Yeah, it was very, very mind expanding in some ways. There were a lot of topics where I was familiar with it, but in others that I just had no, hadn't really given it any thought at all. And the best example of that was colonisation. So doing a topic of the foundations of Hauora Māori, and pretty arrogantly thought that I knew a little bit about Te Ao Māori, having done school certificate in Te Reo when I was at high school, being part of the Kapa Haka group and, you know, having lots of friends who are Māori, but that's just not it. And because I can pronounce words relatively well, and when I call people's names out in the waiting room, they're happy and surprised, I guess I've kind of been resting on that as a sort of demonstration that I'm pretty good with these kind of things. But going through that course, it really made me realise that I've just made lots of assumptions that I know what I'm talking about. And this whole idea that whiteness being normal and that being the ideal to which everything else is compared, I just had never thought of that before. It just had never come, of course, because I'm a white woman. And so that was quite confronting. And it made me think about all the ways that Western ideals and Western ideas are just seen as an absolute assumption of normal. And one of the things about me and one of my values I hold most dear in my practice is that I run on time. And this is a thing that my patients know and they value as well. And patients who come to see me from other of my partners are always warned to be on time for Vanessa because she'll be on time. But I realised during this course that time is this concept that's a Western idea that was brought to New Zealand. This is not, you know, it's not the, it's just not the same thing for everybody. Time works differently. It's really a psychological thing and a social construct. And so the fact that I've been pushing that expectation on to all of my patients, you know, Māori, Pacific, everybody, was racist. It was kind of a horrible realization that I was accidentally being racist in the way that I was seeing people if they didn't turn up on time. So I fundamentally changed the way that I approach things, and my patients still turn up on time generally, but if people don't turn up on time, I just rebook things and am much more flexible than I used to be around that. I used to just say, no, they definitely have to have a different appointment. I can't, you know, I'm not going to try and fit around them, but now I do.
That must have been an interesting revelation for you, as you're such a strong supporter of the GP business model, and some people would say that the business model couldn't work effectively if you couldn't pin people into those 15 to 20 minute appointments.
Yeah, well, the way that this works and the way that the funding works, it's very hard. You do have to be quite creative about things if you want to make it work. And I think that it works well for people who have complex issues and doesn't work well for mental health problems. Yeah, there's a whole lot of issues where it doesn't work. The funding models that we've got are so complex. You end up with really bizarre incentives for things. You know, the capitated funding model, if it was just on its own, would have some strange incentives. You know, if we were just capitated, we'd be trying our hardest not to see anybody for things, and we would refer as much as possible. But because there's that patient fees aspect of it as well, then there's other drivers. So the thing with funding models is that they do create strange and sometimes unintended consequences. I remember chatting with Des Gorman years ago, and he said to me that when capitation was brought in, GPs instantly took a day a week off. I don't know if that's true. He's typically provocative in that way. But yeah, I think potentially it did make people make some changes. And anytime funding changes, there's going to be impacts. Yeah, I was interviewed by NBR about GP swabbing, and they were kind of implying that GPs are on the make over swabbing. I was trying to explain to them how funding works, and they just clearly didn't get it because they just GPs are only getting paid between $10 and $60 per consult, totally missing that there's capitation funding that goes along. So yeah, all of that complexity is difficult. And they keep changing things and adding stuff to it. There's a zero fees for kids, and that becomes a driver for overuse in the community service card.
The whole capitation formula kind of relies on the idea that GPs will be thinking about not just the person in front of them, but the people who don't come in to see them. And maybe when it was introduced, is it possible there was a lack of education around that aspect of population-based healthcare and funding?
Part of the problem is that we're actually just too busy to do anything other than deal with what's in front of us right now. Although they might think it's a nice idea that we would be thinking about the whole population, you actually have to have time to sit back and think about that, and that there is a cost to that. And so in doing public health and having more time, I've taken a step back and look at how the way, you know, how our practice is working and all that sort of stuff, and thinking about how to do things differently. But that's because I've got time, and I'm taking the cost of that myself, because it's a personal choice not to be seeing patients and making money in that time. And that's my own kind of investment, if you like. But it's not a good business move to do that. It doesn't make you more money. There's no incentive to do that. Although, yes, that's the idea with capitation. I don't think it's a lack of education as such, because actually GPs have done a lot of public health education over time, and actually one of the things I learned and sort of understood from doing this postgrad diploma is that there's a lot of general practice that is actually operationalized public health. And so I really felt there was a lot of benefit from it, but at the same time I think that there is a lot we already know. It's just that it's very difficult in such a pressured environment to actually find the time to do it.
You recently wrote about the inherent savings for the taxpayer that come with the current model and the costs of moving to a nationalised or salaried model for general practice. I thought that was a really, really interesting article. It seems hard to sell that message to the government and DHBs and the Ministry of Health, even though you were able to attach quite a large price tag in terms of savings from the GP workforce. I mean, is that an issue the NZMA can help develop?
Yeah, it's something I'm thinking a bit more and more about, and about how you communicate with politicians and explain these kind of concepts. It's because I was talking with Dave Geller actually recently about work as imagined versus work as done. And people in bureaucratic positions and politicians have ideas about how things are done. And they have this kind of imaginary power that they think when I say that something's going to happen, that it's just going to happen like done. Like when the Prime Minister says everyone's going to be tested at the border, we're going to have a real focus on all of the border workers, we're really in tight quarantine, everything's going to be done, that they're just going to magically happen. And without understanding that there's actually really complex relationships and networks and funding issues that go all around that, that just tie everything up. And they've got this imaginary idea about the system and how it works, and how it actually works and how things actually get done are quite different. And it's quite funny because Des Gorman actually wrote an article in the New Zealand Medical Journal, him and Murray Horn, about how they think a border quarantine sort of outfit should be working. And they sort of use the terms command and control, and that there needs to be, you know, this needs to be really tightened up and right away, which, you know, I agree. But the funny thing is that people think that command and control works, but actually command and control comes from the military, and that is not how the military works in actual real terms. Truly how the military works is based on relationships and trust and a shared set of values. And so their values are articulated and lived from the top down. So courage, comradeship, commitment and integrity, everybody knows that in the Defence Force, and everybody's living that, and it's reinforced through their leadership training and everything that they do. And that and a set of planning tools that are universal to all militaries and standardized lines of communication and decision making is how things actually get done. But the chief of the army can't say this is how it will be and it will happen. They have to write an order. And even if they write an order, there's only about a 50% chance that everything that they order will actually get done. And so their staff officers have to massage this through the system. They have to be talking to their mates down the chain and letting them know that this is coming up and, you know, make sure the boss really wants this to happen. This is how it's got to do. Make sure the guys and girls have got it all sorted. And nothing just happens because somebody says it happens. Mm. I was just thinking about how would we actually then set up communications and get people to understand you? It is kind of interesting because I think people, they don't hear things and they don't understand things when it's outside of their expectation. So if it doesn't fit in their understanding and their belief system, then they just truly, it does not sink in. And so if you're saying something that is counter to what they already believe, that is a cognitive error that people make. They will not hear it. And I think that's why they didn't listen to us about the flu vaccines being a debacle. They had their beliefs already that this was how it's going to be. And so people have got their ideas and beliefs about how it could all be better if GPs were just salaried. But those people are often people who are salaried and have never worked in a role like general practice, actually. Peter Crampton, and I can't remember who else it was, talking about the elephant in the room a year or so ago. And I thought, wow, has Peter ever actually worked in general practice and ever actually worked in an environment where when you work more, you earn more money? And that is actually a key part of productivity. And there's aspects of that that are positive. There are also drawbacks to it. And I think that you need to understand the productivity impact, because people keep talking about the productivity in the hospitals and the impact there. And what does they actually mean and what are they actually talking about? And you actually have to think about the impact that it would truly have. And part of me would love to be salaried again. I mean, I was salaried when I was in the Defence Force, and there was a sort of gloriousness to that when there's nobody that turns up or nothing happening, that you can actually do whatever university papers you happen to be doing at the time, or just go out for a run in the sun. You know, you can actually just live your life a little bit more and not be bound just by what needs to be happening in front of you. So
many GPs themselves feel a tinge of guilt for charging for what they do. But in fact, as you say, it is that whole skin in the game that produces productivity in general practice that the entire health system benefits from. The fact that if we had a totally salaried primary care system, it would cost us a lot more. Besides that, is there any evidence that would actually improve the health outcomes?
Yeah, I think that would be very interesting. I think pretty much probably not. In fact, it may do the opposite because of the reduction in productivity, and it may actually make it harder to see a GP. It might make us think about doing things differently, but is that going to be any better? I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is I think there's some value in continuity of care. I think there's a lot of value in that, and getting to know a person and building relationships. And GPs know that that's the true value that we add, is that people trust us because they know us. We've done things together before where things have worked well or not well. And that relationship over time, you can't replicate that. And it's not a task orientated thing. It's a interaction and it's a very personal thing. And I feel that part of the reason that a lot of Māori and Pacifica and other low socioeconomic people have poorer outcomes, one of the reasons might be that they have to move so often that it's very hard to actually have a GP practice where a nurse or a GP becomes somebody that you have a relationship with, because you've moved, you know, you don't have that contact. I think there is subtle stuff that we do that it's hard to put a figure on. It's hard to put a value on that. When I talked about that $1 billion, that's just GPs I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the value that the nurses add. I wouldn't even begin to put a price on that either, but they're definitely contributing a whole lot more to the system as well. And people don't understand that often GP owners are paying their nurses and they're paying for all of the buildings that are there and they're paying all of that. So the infrastructure that we support and invest in and the management of those facilities and the management of the staff and all of those things, that would require a whole lot of huge level of bureaucracy. So I didn't even calculate that. I'm just talking about the GPs. So if we add in, imagine the bureaucracy you'd need to have to for facilities management for all of the GP practices. I think there's about 1,000 buildings or something like that across the country. You'd need to upgrade all of those buildings. You'd need maintenance plans. You'd need all of the things that we do, all of the insurance that's provided for all of that. Yeah, all of those things. That's how much we save. And I don't know what that figure is. It'd be stupendous.
One of the advantages and disadvantages of the small business model in general practice is by nature you need to be conservative to protect the financial viability of the practice. But at the same time, we're in a period where we're talking about a new normal. We saw GPs go into video and telephone consultations in a very short period of time, which shows they have the flexibility and nimbleness to change. And I just wonder, do you have any hopes that some of that non-conservative response can carry on? And is it actually possible while the funding stays the same? Is it the funding that actually stops general practice from taking on a lot of these new initiatives?
No, I don't think it's funding. I think it's you've got to have a reason to do it. And it was very clear, and it's actually not radical or particularly innovative to do telehealth or video consults anymore. And it probably hasn't been for the last 10 years. It's just that we haven't done it and we haven't really had any need to. And, you know, there's a lot of inertia because if you're going along and doing things quite well and everything's going okay, you have to say, well, is this going to be beneficial to the business and do patients want it? It's kind of one of those, is it going to make the ship go faster kind of questions? And before there was no kind of driver and there was no obvious incentive to do it. But then all of a sudden, pretty much overnight, it became this has to be done. And everybody understood, or pretty much universally, the requirement and agreed, yep, this is the obvious thing that has to be done, and it is done.
Papanui Medical Center, where you work, was quite a radical practice in its own time. It was part of its own IPA, and it was an IPA that crossed Cook Strait and joined up with Karori and Ropata. Now, you're actually involved in a number of Pegasus boards, and I'm just wondering if, given that we've recently got telehealth and video consults having a much higher profile in general practice, has this been a long time coming? Do you feel like PHOs could have done a better job at pulling general practice along?
Well, I think they did actually have some things on the back burner that they were working on. So ProCare and Pegasus did have a virtual GP and a kind of kit kind of thing that they were working on. And it was just sort of dawdling along without much attention in the background. And we did actually do in the small group teaching for Pegasus, we actually did do last year, we did a digital health and telemedicine small group round and spoke about different things then. So that was well and truly ahead. So I don't think they've been remiss. It's just that people make choices in their own workplace.
We did a few words with you last year, and I hope I have my notes right, but I think you described PHOs as bureaucracies akin to self-licking ice creams.
Yes, self-licking ice creams is a term that is used a lot in the military to explain people or organisations that are there mainly for their own benefit and that spend a majority of their energy on their own needs and requirements. And I'm not entirely sure that my view has changed terribly about that, although I think that the aims that Pegasus have are really worthy, the charitable objects and the population focus and that sort of thing. And I do still think that there is a challenge over maintaining that focus. And so, yeah, I wouldn't call them maybe, I wouldn't say Pegasus is self-licking ice cream. I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say it now.
When we last spoke, it was on the popcorn panels and we were chatting about the Simpson Report. You've had a month or so to digest the report. Does it still cause you as much concern as it did when it first came out?
Actually, at the moment, being in Canterbury, it causes me more concern. And in fact, I kind of almost wake up in a cold sweat at night, hoping that they don't put Heather Simpson in as the commissioner. I'm certain there's going to be a commissioner. They just have to put somebody in. You know, and then that they don't then use Canterbury as the launching pad for the restructure of things and say, right, well, this is clearly where we start and let's make this the prototype DHB but I could see why there would be a temptation for that to happen. When you say ring fencing primary care funding, I mean, they've already in the DHB deficit cutting budget has indicated some of their discretionary funding for general practice is going to be axed. For community care, $1.72 million, I'm not sure what that is. There's some lifestyle programs that are going to be cut and something else. But, I mean, we've already had youth sexual health funding from them cut. We've had end-of-life funding that for palliative care that we used to have severely cut back. Over the last couple of years, they've been cost-cutting and cost-containing quite a lot. So we've had that, and we know what that experience is. And the experience is that they tell us that this is going to happen, and no matter what, how much pushback the PHO tries to get, they've got very little traction, and it's just kind of dealt to us.
You talked before about the Army and that so much is based on relationships and trust. As far as I've seen over the last three decades in the health sector, there's been a real failure to entrench good relationships and trust between primary care and secondary care.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that Canterbury's held up as kind of one of the golden children of this idea of integration and relationships between primary and secondary care. And certainly I think when Canterbury Initiative first started and some of the health pathways things were working, it was quite good. They'd have panels of GPs and hospital specialists that would work together to figure out what were the rub points in the system and how they could work through them together. And then there's pathways would come out of those. But over time, that has definitely morphed and there's much less general practice involvement in those processes. Usually what happens is a group of interested specialists have got a problem in the hospital that they need to solve. They come up with things that they would like GPs to do. I don't know what the process is there from there. I think they always say there's some GP involvement somewhere along the line, which I think is actually one person who's appointed for a couple of tenths to give some advice. There's no process where we can say, actually, no, we're not doing that. And this is all going to come to a huge head very, very soon with all of these cuts.
So, Vanessa, how serious are the deficit problems in Canterbury for primary care? For so many people, it would be a case of reading figures in the newspaper and translating $175 million deficit into the impact at the front line can be quite difficult.
The deficit itself is one thing. It's more that the cost cutting that they've got to make to try and reduce the deficit that will have the impact. I think it's impossible to reduce such a deficit without cutting services or staff. And given that the first line of service of cuts was actually to nursing staff, it seems impossible that you could reduce nursing staff without reducing care to patients. So to say that there'll be no reduction in services, I think will be very hard to live up to, if not be an outright lie. You cannot expect people to be forced to go on leave, for example, because part of their deficit might also be associated with a outstanding leave balance. You know, that is a liability. And expect that people will not be replaced, and therefore, if they're not replaced, service delivery will be reduced. And so that has an impact on people. When 80% of the budget is their people, deficits can't be reduced without affecting either staff numbers or staff pay or some aspect of service delivery. So that's what's going to happen. And there'll be more that's pushed back to general practitioners to deal with. And we're actually quite busy doing our own work. And we rely on our secondary colleagues and other specialists to help our patients with things that we actually can't do in our settings or that would be prohibitively expensive for us or for our patients. And so I don't know what the quantum of unmet need that's going to come out of this is going to be, but I imagine it's going to be quite a big problem for patients. You know, already think about all the patients who are suffering in pain because of their hips and knees that aren't able to be done, you know, that aren't able to be replaced, and who are every day thinking about how do I get through and just waiting for that appointment. And so many people that we manage with physiotherapy and in the pools and all that sort of thing. They haven't said there'll be a reduction in the number of surgeries or anything like that, but it's hard to imagine that it won't have some impact there. So, yeah, I don't know what it'll look like exactly, but it'll be service delivery reductions.
If you had the ear of a new incoming health minister, whoever that might be, in your role as GP Council Chair, What are you going to say to them about what needs to happen for primary care and general practice to actually play the key role they could be playing in the health system?
Yeah, well, they need to do what they said they would do if it's a Labor MP. Last time they said that they would do an urgent review of the funding of general practice. And that's what needs to happen, because we know that we've known for years that it doesn't work properly, and that they've said themselves that general practice has been underfunded for years. So they need to urgently fix that. And I don't think there's, I don't have the exact answer, but that's what they need to do.
Well, Vanessa, we're coming towards the end now, and I was thinking, in your few words, you said if you weren't a doctor, you would like to sit on an isolated beach counting birds.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think at that time, a friend of mine that I grew up with in Canberstown was doing that. She works for DOC and gets to go to places like Macquarie Island and down into the Auckland Islands and photographs birds and just counts them, you know, for their population numbers. And so, yeah, the idea of being on a isolated place and not having to deal with people occasionally actually is very appealing. I love people, of course. Also love the idea of no people around.
So thank you, Vanessa. All the best with your role as chair of the GP Council, and good luck with battling the bureaucracies that are holding general practice back.
Thanks very much, Barbara. Cheers.
Thanks for tuning in to Primary Thinking, brought to you by The Health Media, proud publishers of New Zealand Doctor, Rāte Aotearoa, Pharmacy Today, Kaitiaki, Rongoa, O Te Wā, e-learning, and The Roster, Te Rārangi. My name is Barbara Fountain, and I look forward to catching up with you again soon.